The United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit is now open and in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
The first case this morning is AISG versus Secretary of the Army, number 20-2105. Mr. Anika, you've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. May I use 2 minutes of that rebuttal on my direct?
Sure. So you just want to reserve three?
Yes.
Okay. Michael, I think we'll take care of that on the time, but we'll watch it too. You may proceed.
Yes. May it please the court. The court should overturn the decision of the contract for four reasons that we articulated in our briefs. First and foremost, the board simply ignored one of the fundamental issues that were argued below, which is the implied duty of good faith and fair dealing. Moreover, not only in ignoring that issue, it missed a substantial amount of facts, both in the August to December timeframe and other undisputed facts that would have established that the duty of good faith and fair dealing was breached. Second, the record establishes sufficiently that there was a significant breach of the good faith and fair dealing duty, such that this court either itself, based on the record or on remand, could direct that entry of liability be entered against the Secretary of the Army. Third, because the board erred with respect to its determination that there wasn't an 8-month delay, which in fact the Corps of Engineers admitted in its basic change document. And fourth, because the board erred with respect to finding that there was no differing site condition. First, I'll deal briefly with the omission to address the good faith and fair dealing. It's quite clear that that occurred. It's simply not mentioned in the decision. No facts, no discussion were mentioned about it. And because of that, the board did not consider the period from August to December 2012, which, as we've articulated in the briefs, it contained a whole host of facts where the Corps of Engineers whipsawed AISG. But it also omits a whole series of other facts that were undisputed, which also support the fact that the good faith and fair dealing obligation was breached. The government argues that one should forgive that either because the board addressed it sub silentio or that there was harmless error. That simply can't be the case. One cannot have, if one looks at Agility or McKee or the other cases we cited, the failure to articulate any reason regarding a major fact, major legal issue, simply can't be excused. And on that basis alone, this court should reverse the decision of the board. Moving on to the good faith and fair dealing argument. You know, although the claim of AISG focuses on the period from May to December 2012, under the rubric of the Lewis-Nicholson case, which on its early pages discussed the fact that the groundwork of this breach started 2 years before. It started when AISG had to alert the Corps that Site 1 had been overrun by military activities. They weren't aware of it. It continues in selecting a site that surrounds the only security point and proposes to breach the security wall of a village. It continues in a license, which was not made available to AISG, that on page 14, as the judge at the board, Judge Kinner, asserted...
Mr. Anikoff, are you saying that the selection of Site 2 itself was a breach of the good faith and fair dealing?
No, Your Honor. It shows, what we're showing is that the court's really bureaucratic indifference existed for a long time before we got to Site 2. So that is just another example that the Corps wasn't paying attention and didn't care. And
so your client agreed to Site 2?
Ultimately, it did. But that was not what it originally signed to, but it did agree to Site 2. And it visited. And the OE that it expected was a site which they could bring bulldozers on, knock down the AMP, and move forward. And that proved to be impossible. And with regard to that in the good faith and fair dealing argument,
didn't the board make contrary findings that even though Site 3 was ultimately chosen and is preferable to you, that you agreed to Site 2 and that you could have moved forward on it?
Well, in agreeing to Site 2, we agreed that we could do two things. We could physically take down the AMD, and we could physically remove the wall if that was necessary. But what the board didn't consider is the undisputed testimony of the court appearing on pages 295 to 312 of the record, where the project engineer and the contracting officer unequivocally testify that, one, the AMP had to come down, two, that the Corps of Engineers had to take the AMP down because it was a sovereign police force, that a contractor could not come and take it down, and as the contracting officer testified on page 298, that if ASG had walked up to the AMP and suggested they leave, they would have been laughed off and ignored. So the fact is, it's undisputed that AISG could not remove the AMP force and that it had to be removed, and that what it agreed to was the ROE, which was right of access. The right of access also included the obligation to be able to enter the AMP to take it down, and that never occurred, and that's what triggered the obligation of the Corps to assist it. Now, we're not claiming the period from January to May.
Can you point to anything in the record where you asked the government to assist in taking down the AMP and they refused?
No, Your Honor, and the reason was that everybody knew it, the project engineer, the contracting officer, and we knew it. That was an understood fact, and we were waiting for that to occur. It didn't occur. The explicit point in the record where we made that request is ultimately in RFI 4, which was late in the game, where we said you either have to move to Site 3 or go get official permission. But prior to then, it was simply understood there was no ambiguity. There was no need to go ask.
It was excuse me, this is Judge Stahl. In response, though, there was some communication from the government saying, hey, you were supposed to do certain activity on Site 2, and you haven't yet. And there was some push from the government for AISG to take some action on Site 2. Did AISG ever respond, well, we can't do anything yet because you have not done what you need to do first?
Yes, well, yes, Your Honor. The first activity that was required to be done was the site preparation, the geotesting, and the leveling. The problem was that that had to be done at the high ground where the AMP was located. And so it couldn't be commenced until...
Where did you communicate that to the government, that it couldn't be commenced until the government had the AMP removed?
I know it's in dialogue. I can't put my... I can file something with the court. I believe that was in communications. It was understood that one needed to geotest the site, demine it, because that's what occurred on Site 3. And there is evidence in the record that the first thing that that AISG was in creating their logistics staging zone next to Site 2, they had to demine it, they had to clear it, and they had to do geotesting. And all of that on Site 2 would have had to have occurred at the location of the AMP, which the board agreed. The board agreed that the AMP had to be moved to do the construction. So it was undisputed, as I've noted, that the Corps of Engineers had to do the removing of the AMP. And that was either based on the ROE, a contractual obligation, or the fact that when everybody arrived, there was opposition. The opposition is not disputed. It's throughout the record. And AISG were the only people on site. They were living and breathing and working with the locals, the AMP and the villagers. Nobody from the Corps ever came out, not from February, March, April, May. In July, two members of the Corps came out, and they immediately agreed that they need to move to Site 3. And it wasn't until the project engineer came in December when she, too, decided that very day that it was necessary to move to Site 3. And the fact of opposition, the board and the government repeatedly say that no violence was visited on AISG. There is no statute, regulation, or case law in this jurisdiction or anywhere else that said a contractor needs to be shot or to suffer what occurred in Afghanistan to prove that there is significant opposition. We were embedded there. AISG was embedded there. They knew the opposition, and they were conveying it. It was conveyed increasingly in RFI 1 and then in RFI 2 in letters, and in RFI 3 in more letters and the ministry support, and ultimately in RFI 4. So it's clear that there was opposition, and that's the very kind of situation where the government can't stand mute, hiding in bunkers and not provide help. The only thing that was required was a project engineer to come out to the site. And one has to remember that this is in Fort Belvoir in Washington. This is at the top of the mountain at the end of the road in Afghanistan. It is some of the most violent places on the world. And one needs to keep that in mind when thinking about how this happens. It's not just a simple little bit of contract. It was necessary, not unlike the R.W. Jones case where they were trying to build river abutments. I know that's not binding on the court, but the facts are not dissimilar. Where one encounters difficulties, the duty of implied of good faith and fair dealing includes cooperation. It includes doing what's necessary, quote, to enable the contractor to perform and then not to interfere. And so both of those duties were breached. They were breached in the duty to cooperate and help resolve the ANP issue. And then from May, when the Corps invited...
Can I just ask you one more time, Mr. Annika?
Yes.
How did they breach a duty to resolve the ANP issue when you didn't ask them to move it?
Because they always knew they had the issue. That's the point. It's undisputed in the record. They knew it. We knew it.
Where in the record does it show that that your progress at Site 2 had progressed to the point where the ANP had to be moved? It seems to me that the problem here was you didn't want to build on Site 2, and you asked over and over again to move to Site 3, and the government ultimately acceded, but you didn't even complete the initial, and I don't know the record completely well, but some submittals and things like that to move forward and progressing to Site 2 before the question of moving the ANP would have even come up.
Well, Your Honor, moving the ANP is the initial act. If you look at the contract, it says the first thing that AISG is to demolish all buildings. So the ANP had to come down first. Once the ANP came down, you can do the geotesting at the site to prepare your submittals. And until you do that, you can't prepare the submittals.
So where in the record is your response to the government when they say you're not moving forward quickly enough on your submittals, that the response that before we can do this, you need to remove the ANP?
Those were the responses to the letter of concern in April, to the cure notice in August, and the show cause in December, where we explained at some length the reasons why what was occurring was occurring. We admitted that we started out at Site 3 incorrectly. And part of that was, be a mistake or otherwise, when Mr. Riles gave the coordinate, he is the project engineer, although he can't change the contract, that's where they all started. And that was by mistake. And we're not laying any claim to what occurred up until May, which is the date that the Corps invited us to submit a request to change the site. So up until then, the best I can say, Your Honor, is it wasn't asked because everybody understood it. The project engineer, the contracting officer, and AISG all understood it, and nothing happened.
Mr. Anakis, one thing that the board emphasized repeatedly was that when you were submitting those RFIs to change the site from Site 2 to Site 3, there was no statement or suggestion that Site 2 was unworkable or that anything in particular needed to be done, for example, with the ANF. I mean, what is your response to that? Why isn't that a reasonable thing for the board to rely on in making its fact findings?
Your Honor, in submitting RFIs 1 to 4, it was very clear that the ANP chief and the villagers all opposed Site 2. and that was become increasingly vocal. So, as I've said before, the reason we couldn't start on Site 2 was because the AMP was there.
I understand. Let me ask you one other question. The board also relied on Mr. Francis's testimony, who said that the AMP post did not present a problem. Why couldn't the board rely on that as evidence supporting its fact findings?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Mr. Francis was a corporate official. He was not on site. And there were all sorts of discussions that went on about whether you could or couldn't perform at Site 2. He was the view that you might be able to.
He's the AISG vice president, right?
He was a corporate official.
Okay. I mean, so his representations matter, right? Whether he was on site or not.
They did matter, and it was an assessment that somehow that we could try to do it. In fact, AISG said that they would make it work if they had to. At the end, it was clear that you couldn't site adapt until you took down the AMP.
So, I think we've run through all of your time, including your rebuttal. Let's hear from the government. I'll restore 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. The decision below should be affirmed for two reasons. First, the board did not commit prejudice or error, or any error for that matter, in not specifically addressing the legal elements of AISG's duty of good faith and fair dealing claim. And second, the remainder of AISG's arguments in this appeal amount to an impermissible request for this court to reweigh the evidence and retry its case in AISG's favor. On the good faith and fair dealing point, even though the board did not specifically address the legal elements of such a claim, the board made a multitude of factual findings that are relevant to any good faith and fair dealing claim that AISG may have presented to the board. AISG primarily claimed that it had a reasonable expectation that it was going to receive a tenable site in Site 2, and that additionally, the Army Corps somehow did not move quickly enough in approving AISG's request to move to Site 3 from Site 2. The board on these points, in approximately 10 pages of factual findings, concluded that AISG failed to establish that it was prohibited from building at Site 2 during the relevant period.
Mr. Byrd, AISG's argument, at least here today, seems to rest primarily upon removing the AMP outpost and that it was impossible to proceed until that was done. What board fact findings support the notion, the conclusion that didn't cause a breach of the good faith and fair dealing?
Your Honor, the board finds that in AISG's proposal to build at Site 2, AISG represented to the Army Corps that it had visited the site in July 2011 and had determined that it could remove the AMP post as part of performing at Site 2. And in that proposal, the contractor presented no concerns about performing at Site 2, including moving the AMP post. The board also found that to the extent AISG presumed that the government would clear the whatever occupants there may have been at the AMP post, that was simply an unwarranted presumption, and that it would have been a patent ambiguity, essentially, if AISG had done the site visit and then saw the AMP post and did not inquire of the government about whose obligation it would have been to remove potential occupants of that post. So that ultimately it was unproven on AISG's part, who had the burden here, that it could not move whatever occupants of the post because the record revealed that AISG actually never attempted to perform it at Site 2 at all. And again, this is following AISG having represented to the government as part of its proposal to perform at Site 2 that it could perform and build the headquarters at Site 2 without any concerns. The board also found as a antithetical to any good faith and fair dealing claim in the case, that the eventual adoption of Site 3 as the project location did not undermine the Army Corps' reliance and sticking to Site 2 as a project site before moving to Site 3. And in that regard, the Army Corps has a license to construct, as the court is aware, that set the limits of the ability and the authority to build in the host country. In the end, regarding the board's, that the board did not address specifically the good faith and fair dealing claim, the board did conclude that specifically that there is no legal theory upon which AISG can support its claim. And the board, in that regard, certainly appears to have considered each possible legal theory and concluded that AISG cannot support its claim. Turning to a couple of specific allegations from Mr. Enekeet this morning, he mentioned the board not mentioning certain facts between August and December 2012. That amounts to, in some ways, concerns with the board's credibility determinations. Several of the facts, as articulated in Mr. Enekeet's brief, amount to the board's weighing of testimony from AISG's witnesses itself, and that a disagreement with mentioning them in the opinion is not error for this court to reverse, given the administrative judge is presumed to have considered all facts in the record, and there's nothing in the opinion in this case that gives the court any pause in having considered the entire record. Additionally, when Mr. Enekeet mentioned this morning the changed circumstance in December 2012, when the Army Corps did actually approve the site to change to Site 3, by that point, the record demonstrates that the circumstances simply had changed. By December 2012, when the project was moved to Site 3, the Army Corps accepted from AISG the authority that AISG had obtained from the Ministry of the Interior to move to Site 3. The board found it reasonable on the Army Corps' part before it received such authority to have held AISG to Site 2, given, again, the limitations in the license to construct that the Army had, and that the board found not to be infirm, despite contrary allegations made by AISG before the board. Turning to the other, just briefly, Your Honor, the other parts of the case which amount to a request for this court to reweigh the evidence, and that is primarily the change claim and the destructive, differing site conditions claim in this case. And to be brief, there simply is no change that occurred, given that the agency was attempting to hold the contractor to the bargain that it agreed to. The Army Corps was requiring AISG to perform at the site that it agreed to in modification to under the contract, and therefore there was no direction to perform extra contractual work, and therefore no change. Regarding the differing site condition claim, that would have required there to have been a physical condition at the site that differed materially from those in the contract or otherwise reasonably encountered in this type of work. And here, neither the occupants of the ANC post nor the villagers themselves could constitute such a physical condition, as they were known or should have been known definitely by the proposal presented by the contractor to perform at Site 2. And if there are no further questions, I can conclude.
For the we'll hear from Mr. Enekeet. You have 3 minutes.
Thank you.
Mr. Enekeet, you're still on mute.
Sorry, Your Honor.
That's okay.
On to Mr. Byrd. First, what AISG proposed was what it does. It constructs and it demolishes. And what it found was something different. It found a foreign police force that it had the right to have not there. The undisputed testimony that the Corps agreed that they had to do it, and they didn't do it. The duty of good faith and fair dealing sits outside of the contract. It exists when problems occur, and that is the obligation that the Corps had. For whatever reason, it had to cooperate and not hamper the ability of AISG to do its job. The argument that there's no legal theory that the board made, there's nothing to indicate that it considered the duty of good faith and fair dealing. If one looks at the Agility case and some of the others we signed, this court has never held that complete silence about a major issue suffices to treat something as having been dealt with sub silentio. With regard to credibility, the board only...
Mr. Aneka, can I just ask you about that last point? Even if we agree with you that the board didn't address the duty of good faith and fair dealing, if we conclude that the factual findings otherwise support that there was no breach, can't we just decide that it was harmless error?
I know you dispute
that the factual findings support that, but why wouldn't that be subject to a harmless error analysis?
Oh, I think Your Honor can't do that because there were so many facts that weren't considered by the court, by the board below, and that its failure to address them in the context of the good faith and fair dealing would preclude this court from finding harmless error. There are simply too many facts that were in the record that the board didn't consider to allow you to do that.
What about the fact findings that the board made on the bottom of page A11? It's the last paragraph on page A11, and there's a lot of fact findings there that I think, if they're supported by substantial evidence, they're very pertinent to your argument. Specifically, fact findings that AISG did not encounter physical interference, that the residents, there was no evidence that the residents or police were asked to cooperate, or that AISG employees asked the FN to honor the prior license. There's a lot of different facts there. I just want to make sure that I understand your position. You think those facts do not undermine your argument of good faith and fair dealing breach?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I believe that the board was passing on to this project a standard that doesn't apply, which is that AISG had to show violence or physical opposition in order to prove its point. And that has never been the standard. And I think we have to rest on this. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Aneka. Mr. Byrd, the case will be submitted.